He renounced nothing when he retired into the solitude, for it cannot be looked upon as an act of renunciation if we throw away a thing which is a burden to us. He cannot be called an ascetic, for he does not undergo any discipline or process of hardening. It is no act of self-denial to refuse things which we do not want. The true ascetic is he who lives in the world, surrounded by its temptations, he in whose soul the animal elements are still active, craving for the gratification of their desires and possessing the means for their gratification, but who by the superior power of his will conquers his animal self. Having attained that state, he may retire from the world and employ his energies for the employment and the further expansion of the spiritual power which he possesses. He will be perfectly happy, because that which he desires he can create in his own interior world. He expects no future reward in heaven, for what could heaven offer to him except happiness which he already possesses? He desires no other good but to create good for the world. If you could establish theosophical academies where intellectual and spiritual development would go hand in hand, where a new science could be taught, based upon a true knowledge of the fundamental laws of the universe, and where at the same time man would be taught how to obtain mastery over himself, you would confer the greatest possible benefit upon the world. Such a convent would, moreover, afford immense advantages for the advancement of intellectual research. The establishment of a number of such places of learning would dot the mental horizon of the world with stars of the first magnitude, from which rays of intellectual light would stream and penetrate the world. Standing upon a far higher plane than the material science of our times, a new and far greater field would be laid open for investigation and research in these centers. Knowing all the different opinions of the highest accepted authorities, and not being bound by an orthodox scientific creed, having at their service all the results of the investigations of the learned, but not being bound to their systems by a belief in their infallibility, such people would be at liberty to think freely. Their convents would become centers of intelligence, illuminating the world, and if their power of self-control would grow in equal proportion with the development of their intellect, they would soon be able to enter adeptship. The adept had spoken these words with unusual warmth, as if he intended to appeal to my sympathy and to induce me to use my efforts to establish such convents. There was a look of pity in his eyes, as if he exceedingly regretted the state of poor ignorant humanity, with whose karma he was not permitted to interfere forcibly, according to the established rules of his order. I, too, regretted my own inability to establish such academies, and for once I wished that I were rich, so as to be able to make at least an attempt with one such establishment. But immediately the imperator saw my thought in my mind, and said, "You mistake, it is not the want of money which prevents us from executing this idea, it is the impossibility of finding at present the proper kind of people to inhabit the convent after it is established. Indeed, we would be poor alchemists if we could not produce gold in any desirable quantity, if some real benefit for humanity could be effected thereby, and of this I shall convince you, if you desire it. But gold is a curse to mankind, and we do not wish to increase the curse from which humanity suffers. Distribute gold among men, and you will only create a craving for more. Give them power, and you will transform them into devils. No, it is not gold that we need, it is men who thirst after true wisdom. There are thousands who desire knowledge, but few who desire wisdom. Intellectual development, sagacity, craftiness, cunning, are today mistaken for spiritual development, but this conception is wrong. Animal cunning is not intelligence, craftiness is not wisdom, and most of your learned men are the last ones who can bear the truth. Even many of your would-be occultists and so-called Rosicrucians have taken up their investigations merely for the purpose of gratifying their idle curiosity, while others desire to pry into the secrets of nature to obtain knowledge which they hope to employ for the attainment of selfish ends. Give us men or women who desire nothing else but the truth, and we will take care of their needs. How much money will it require to lodge a person who cares nothing for comfort? What will it take to furnish the kitchen for those who have no desire for dainties? What libraries will be required for those who can read in the book of nature? What external pictures will please those who wish to avoid a life of the senses and to retire within their own selves? What terrestrial scenery shall be selected for those who live within the paradise of their souls? What company will please those who converse with their own higher self? How can we amuse those who live in the presence of God? Here the adept paused for a moment, and then continued, saying, "Verily the theosophical monastery of which I dream is even superior to ours. It is located far away from this earth, and yet it can be reached without trouble and without expense. Its monks and nuns have risen above the sphere of self. They have a temple of infinite dimensions, pervaded by the spirit of sanctity, which is the common possession of all. There the differentiation of the universal soul ceases, and unification takes place. It is a convent where there exists no difference of sex, of taste, opinion, and desire, where vice cannot enter, where none are born, or marry, or die, but where they live like the angels, each one constituting the center of a power for good, each one immersed in an infinite ocean of light, each one able to see all he desires to see, to know all he wants to know, growing in strength and expanding in size, until he embraces the all and is one with it." For a moment it seemed as if the soul of the adept had gone and visited that blissful state of nirvana, a state of which we mortals cannot conceive, but soon the light returned into his eyes, and he smilingly excused himself, saying that he had permitted himself to be carried away by the sublimity of this idea. I ventured to say that probably millions of ages would pass away before mankind would arrive at that state. "Alas," he answered, "the conditions which our present state of civilization imposes upon its followers are now such as to force the vast majority of humanity to employ nearly all their time and energy in an outward direction, instead of employing them for their inward growth. Each man has a certain amount of energy which he may call his own. If he wastes his energy on the outward plane, either for the attainment of sensual gratification or in intellectual pursuits, he will have nothing left to nourish the divine germ in his heart. If he continually concentrates his mind outwardly, there will be no inward concentration of thought, which is absolutely necessary for the attainment of self-knowledge. The laboring classes, men of commerce, scientists, doctors, lawyers, and clergymen are all actively engaged in outward affairs, and find little time for the inward concentration of their powers. The majority are continually occupied in running after shadows and illusions, which are at best only useful as long as they last, but whose usefulness ceases when the heart ceases to beat. Their time and energy are taken up in procuring what they call the necessaries of life, and they excuse themselves by saying that it is their misfortune to be so situated as to be forced to procure them. Nature, however, cares nothing for our excuses. The law of cause and effect is blind and inaccessible to argumentation. A man climbing over a mountain top and falling over a precipice is as much in danger of breaking his neck as if he had jumped down voluntarily. A man who is not able to progress will be left as far behind as one who does not desire to progress. But nature is not so cruel as she appears to be to the superficial observer. That which man requires for the purpose of living is very little indeed, and can usually be easily obtained, for nature has amply provided for all of her children, and if they cannot all obtain their proper share, then there must be something seriously wrong, either with them individually or with the social organization as a whole. There is undoubtedly a great deal wrong in our social organization, and our philosophers and politicians are continually trying to remedy it. They will succeed in their task when they succeed in making the laws of the human world harmonies with the laws of nature, and not before. That event may take place in the far distant future. We have not the time to wait for it. Let each one attempt to restore harmony in his own individual organism and live according to natural laws, and the harmony of the social organism as a whole will be restored. The words of the adept caused me some irritation, for I loved the comforts of life. A spirit of contradiction arose within me and caused me to say, "Would you, then, do away with all luxuries, which at our present stage of civilization have become necessities? Would you have us return to the semi-animal state of our forefathers, living as savages in the woods? I know there are certain cranks that harbor such views." "Not so," answered the adept. The great bulk of those things which are said to be the necessities of life are only artificially created necessities, and millions of people lived and attained old age long before many of the things which our modern civilization considers as absolutely necessary had been discovered or invented. The term necessity has a relative meaning, and to a king a dozen of palaces, to a nobleman a carriage and four, may appear as much a necessity as to a beggar a bottle of whiskey, or to a fashionable man a new swallowtail coat. To get rid at once of all such fancied necessities and the trouble which is imposed upon us to attain them, the shortest and surest way is to rise above such necessities and to consider them not to be necessary at all. Then a great amount of our energy would become free, and might be employed for the acquisition of that which is really necessary, because it is eternal and permanent, while that which serves merely temporal purposes ends in time. There are thousands of people engaged in prying into the details of the constitution of external objects and in learning the chemical and physiological processes going on therein, and some are sacrificing their soul and extinguishing the spark of divinity within themselves by perpetrating the most inhuman cruelties upon their fellow beings for the purpose of gratifying their scientific curiosity and making useless discoveries for the promotion of their ambition. But they do not manifest the least desire to know their own real self, although it would seem that such a knowledge is far more important. Modern science says that she wants to know the laws of nature in all their minute ramifications, and yet she pays no attention whatever to the universal and fundamental law from which all these ramifications spring, and thus she resembles an insect crawling over a fallen leaf and imagining thereby to learn the qualities of the tree. It is surely the prerogative of intellectual man to investigate intellectually all the departments of nature, but the investigation of external things is only of secondary importance to the attainment of knowledge of our own interior powers. All primary powers act from within, effects are secondary to causes. He who considers the knowledge of external things to be more important than the knowledge of God, possesses very little wisdom indeed. God? I exclaimed. What can we know about God? How can you prove that such a being exists? To this answered the adept, I am sorry for a man who is so far backward in his course of spiritual evolution that he is not yet able to recognize the presence of God in everything. The Supreme Spirit which pervades, embraces, and penetrates everything, being the very essence, soul, and life of all things in the universe, from the atom up to the whole solar system, is beyond all mental conception. If he could be grasped by the human intellect, that intellect could have to be greater than God. There is nothing real but God. Nature itself is only a manifestation of his power. Let no man expect that somebody will prove to him the existence of God, but let everyone seek to be himself a living witness of his presence and power by becoming God, like and divine by his divine grace. Man is destined to restore within himself the divine image. When he realizes the divine ideal within his heart, his pilgrimage through manifold incarnations will have ended and the object of his existence be accomplished. Peace be with you. As the adept finished this sentence, a sound as if produced by the tinkling of small silver bells was heard in the air above our heads. I looked up, but nothing was to be seen from which that sound could have proceeded. This is the signal, said the adept, that the members of our order are assembled in the refectory. Let us go to join their company. Some refreshment will undoubtedly be welcome to you. Excerpt from With the Adepts, An Adventure Among the Rosicrucians. London, 1910. By Franz Hartmann. It would be too tedious to some of our readers if I were to report all the instructions that were given to me by my kind guide Theodorus, who, for all I know, may have been known as the celebrated Theophrastus Paracelsus during his life in the physical body. I do not, however, feel myself justified in omitting to tell what he said in regard to the importance of practicing self-control and developing firmness of character and individuality. Previously to my visit to the Rosicrucian convent I had been made to believe that occultism and mysticism were things only for dreamers, adapted to persons living continually in the clouds, enjoying their superstitions and vagaries by building castles in the air, but now, I found, that self-reliance is a most necessary quality for a disciple of this sacred science, and that no science can be more exact than the one based upon our own exact spiritual knowledge and realized within our own soul. Thus Theodorus said, a power to become strong at a center must be directed towards the center, for it is only by resistance that it can accumulate and become strong. A king who goes away from his kingdom and leaves it without protection may find other rulers there when he attempts to return. To become conquerors over nature, we must fight our own battles, and not wait until nature fights them for us. The more the animal elements within man's constitution are stimulated into life and activity by the temptations coming from the external world through the avenues of the senses, the hotter will be the battle, and the stronger will man's power grow if he successfully resists. This is the battle which the great Gautama Buddha fought and from which he came out victorious, because he was overshadowed by the Bo tree of wisdom. I will attempt to give you a rational explanation of the effects of inward concentration, to show you how you may become a creator of your own world. According to the teachings of the sages, the universal spirit called the world into existence by the power of his own thought. All great religions speak of a divine triunity, according to Christianity called the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. The will or intention is the Father, the thought or idea the Son, and the creative power of the Father acting through the Son is the Holy Ghost. By this power the thoughts of the Father become manifest, and thus visible objective worlds are called into existence. But, said I, where does the Father find the material or substance to render these thoughts visible and objective? Within himself, answered my guide, and, looking at me as if to make sure that I understood the meaning of what he said, he continued, Allah il Allah, says the Mohammedan, God is God, and there is nothing beside him. He is the all, matter and motion and space, consciousness, intelligence, wisdom, spirit, substance, energy, darkness, and light. The worlds are his outspoken thoughts, but there is nothing outside of himself of which he might think, he being the all, including and penetrating everything. Thus everything exists within him, who is the life and soul of all things. In him we live and move and have our being, and without him we are nothing. Man is the God and creator of his own little world, and therefore similar processes take place when a person, by the power of introspection, directs his thoughts towards his own center of consciousness within his heart. Now this activity going towards the center could never of itself have created an external world, because the external world belongs to the periphery, and it requires a centrifugal power to call it into existence. The introspective activity of the mind is a centripetal power, and could therefore not act from the center towards the periphery. But you know that every action is followed by a reaction. The centripetal power, finding resistance at the center, returns and evolves a centrifugal activity, and this centrifugal power is called imagination. This soul, energy is the medium between the center and the periphery, between spirit and matter, between the creator and his creations, between God and nature, or whatever names you may choose to give to them. The soul, consciousness is the product of the centrifugal activity of the mind, put into action by the centripetal activity of the will. If these plain facts, expressed in plain language, without any scientific jargon, without circumlocutions, philosophical intricacies and modern gibberish, are comprehensible to you, all you have to do is to apply it to yourself. If you direct the power of your mind inwardly towards your center, instead of letting it fly off at a tangent, the resistance which it finds at the center will cause a reaction, and the stronger the centripetal power which you apply, the stronger will be the centrifugal power created. In other words, the stronger will your soul become, and, as she grows strong, her invisible, but nevertheless material, substance will penetrate your physical, visible body, and serve to transform it into a higher kind. Thus you may at the end become all soul, and have no gross physical body. But long before that time arrives you will be able to act upon matter by the power of your soul, to cure your own bodily ills and those of other people, and to do many wonderful things, even at distances far away from your visible form, for the activity of the soul is not limited by the circumference of the physical form, but radiates far into the sphere of the universal mind. I told Theodorus that these ideas were as yet too grand and too new to me, to be grasped immediately, but that I will attempt to remember them and to meditate about them in the future. You will do well if you do so, said the adept, and I will take care that they remain in your memory. If the doctrines of the sages are true, I replied, it would seem that the vast majority of our thinkers are continually thinking the wrong way, because they are engaged all their lives in prying into the manifestations of life on the outward plane, and do not seem to care a straw about what is taking place within the inner life of the soul. Therefore, answered Theodorus, they will perish with their illusions, and the Bible is right in saying that the ways of the worldly, wise are foolishness in the eyes of the eternal. What will it serve you, if your head is full of speculations about the details of the phenomenal illusions of life, and you become a senile imbecile in your old age? What will it serve you, roaming about the world and gratifying your curiosity in regard to its details, when, after that world has vanished, they forever disappear from your memory? Perhaps it would be better for the learned if they knew less of scientific theories and had more soul knowledge. It would be better if they had fewer theories and more experience. If they were to employ, for instance, some of their time and energy for the development of the spiritual power of clairvoyance, instead of spending it to find out the habits or some species of African monkey, they would fare better by it. If they were to obtain the power to heal the sick by the touch of their hands, instead of seeking new methods to poison humanity by inoculations of injurious substances, humanity would be the gainer. There are thousands of people who work hard all their lives, without accomplishing anything which is really useful or enduring. There are thousands who labor intellectually or mechanically to perform work which had better be left undone. There are vastly more people engaged in undermining and destroying the health of man than in curing his ills, more engaged in teaching error than in teaching the truth, more trying to find that which is worthless than that which is of value. They live in dreams and their dreams will vanish, they run after money, and the money will remain while they themselves perish and die. The obstacles which rise from the external world are intimately connected with those from the inner world, and cannot be separated, because external temptations create inward desires, and inward desires call for external means for gratification. There are many people who do not crave for the illusions of life, but who have not the strength to resist them. They have a desire to develop spiritually and to gain immortality, but employ all of their time and energy for the attainment of worthless things, instead of using it to dive down into the depths of the soul to search for the priceless pearl of wisdom. Thousands of people have not the moral courage to break loose from social customs, ridiculous habits, and foolish usages, which they inwardly abhor, but to which they nevertheless submit because they are customs and habits to act against which is considered to be a social crime. Thus thousands sacrifice their immortality to the stupid goddess of fashion. Who dares to break loose from the bondage imposed upon him by the fashion which at present dominates religious thought? Who has the courage to incur the sneers of the imbecile, the ridicule of the ignorant, the laughter of the fool, and gain thereby a light of whose existence those who live in eternal darkness know nothing? The vast majority of people drown the voice of reason and dance with the fool. Rather than have their vanity suffer, they allow the spirit to starve; rather than be crucified and rise into immortal life, they submit to the galling chain; they lose their appreciation of liberty, and, becoming used to their chains, begin to love them and impose them upon others. I'm not a believer in the total depravity of human nature. I know that man's animal energies, on account of their inherent instinctive efforts for the preservation of their existence, are opposed to the development of his higher principles, because the life of the higher involves the death of the lower. But I also know that in each human being is contained a power for good, which may be made to develop if the proper conditions are given. There are elements of good and elements of evil in every man, and it depends on ourselves which class we desire to develop. From a cherry stone nothing can grow but a cherry tree, from a thistle seed nothing else than a thistle, but man is a constellation of powers in which all kinds of seeds are contained. You may make him grow to be a hog or a tiger, an angel or a devil, a sage or a fool, according to your own pleasure. The continual rush after more money, more comfort, more pleasure, after we already possess all we require, which characterizes our present civilization, is not necessarily a sign of viciousness and moral depravity, but it is rather caused by the instinctive impulse, inherent in the constitution of man, to reach some higher and better condition, which expresses itself on the mundane plane. Man intuitively knows that, no matter how rich in money or fame he may be, he has not yet reached a state in which he will be contented to rest. He knows that he must still keep on striving for something, but he does not know what that something is. Not knowing the higher life, he strives for more of those things which the lower life affords. Thus we may see a bug or a butterfly falling into a lake, and in its vain efforts to save itself from drowning swimming away from the shore, because it does not know in which direction the means for salvation exist. The curse of the world and the root of all evil is ignorance. The curse of man is his ignorance of his higher nature and final destiny, and the efforts of a true system of religion and science ought to be above all to remove this stupidity. But it is also true that ignorance and conceit are closely connected together, and that the ignorant hate him who is wiser than they. If one man, knowing more about the requirements of his nature, and desirous to employ all his energies for the attainment of a higher state, would to dare to assert his manhood and to rebel against the chains of fashion, could he continue to live unmolested in his community? And if he were to emigrate to another, would he not be exposed to the same troubles? He would still come in contact with men who hated freedom because they were educated in chains, who would misunderstand him, suspect his motives, and persecute him, and woe to him if he had any human failings upon which the snake of slander could fasten its poison fangs. Wherever darkness exists, there exists abhorrence of light. Wherever ignorant man enters, there enter his imperfections. Wherever ignorance resides, there are her attending angels, suspicion, envy, and fear. Would it not be more within the scope of a true science to enlighten man about his higher nature, than to dig for worms in the bowels of the material plane? That which is almost impossible to accomplish by the unaided efforts of a single individual, may often easily be accomplished by the co-operation of many, and this law seems to prevail in all departments of nature. If a sufficient number of people were determined to retire from the harlequin stage of the world and to turn away from the tomfooleries of a fashionable existence, they might, if they could harmonize with each other, form a power sufficiently strong to repel the attacks of the monster which would devour them all if they were separated and unaided by each other. Those who are not yet progressed far on the ladder of evolution need those who are upon a higher step to assist them on their upward way, and the higher ones need the lower for their support, in the same sense as a rock needs a solid ground to rest upon and maintain its position.